Welcome back. This is Sheep Stuff You Should Know. This is Dr. Rosie Bush. I'm at UC Davis here, and joined by Ryan Mahoney in Rio Vista. How are you doing, Ryan?
I'm good. Good morning, Dr. Rosie Bush. How are you?
I'm good.
So good.
Drinking my coffee.
Me too. That's what I do at 8 in the morning. That's a kind of a late start, but still, I need coffee. And I was out late last night. I went to a Giants game.
A Giants game.
Yeah, we got an invitation and I couldn't turn it down. So I wore all my Oakland A's gear to the Giants game. And I was the only one in the entire stands. It was great.
That's funny.
The A's gear. And then the pitcher, Logan Webb, he was pitching last night. And his parents and family, we ran into him in an elevator. And I was like embarrassed because I was the only one in A's gear. And then they like, no, he loved the A's growing up. That was his team. That's so cool that you're wearing. Like, it was great. It's like, all right.
That's cool. Awesome.
That was fun. Very cool. What have you been up to? It's been like 2 weeks. I've been running around. I haven't been hard to get a hold of.
Yeah. I have been running around also, but it's been. And we got back from vacation and then the kids Brian got COVID and then I was planning work trips and then I got COVID. So all that got postponed and but it all got done and got to visit some beautiful ranches and work with their wonderful animals. And
I think you got to go up and see some of the best sheep. It's a non-normal breed, but in my opinion, like when you see healthy sheep, like they're just amazing sheep, but you got to see some Perrindales, and that set of Perrindales that you see are some of the best sheep I've ever seen in my life. They're just beautiful animals because they're just so well taken care of, but
they are, they're beautiful.
Yeah. That was super cool that you got to see that. Their wool's pretty amazing too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So we were bleeding for that OPP project. I think I've talked about so it's kind of a newer program that she has introduced there. She brought in some Perrindale genetics from New Zealand. And so when some pure Perrindales came through, I was like, oh my gosh, their wool, it's so shiny and really soft. It was beautiful.
Yeah. The hand on it's incredible. It's very coarse, you know, it's all strong wool. But
it works for up where she is because
you have to have it.
Yeah.
But it's amazing to me though how, like, you know, we measure wool in like micron and length and these different things, but there's really no good measurement for good, like a good soft hand on wool.
Yeah.
Other than just like a feel. Yeah.
And it, when those sheep came through, I mean, we were bleeding at the neck, which is some of the best wool on the animal. And it was just like, oh, wow. Like, it really stood out. It was really neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. They were fun. They were so she took us through the wethers that she had just weaned, and they were some really good looking lambs. And it was pretty fun.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. You've gotten to see some different animals and go to some different places.
We've been traveling. Yeah, we've been traveling. So a friend of ours moved out to Georgia this spring and they're very good family friends. And so we decided my oldest daughter's best friend is their daughter. And so anyway, we wanted to go back and I've been trying to travel rather than like plan my travel around strictly destinations. I try to like plan it around people, like try to visit people and see people. And that's been really cool. So anyway, we went back to Georgia and then on the trip, we went up to Tennessee and I have a good friend over in Tennessee, Mr. Sam Kennedy, who you'll be hearing on the episode that comes out before this one.
Cool.
And so we were able to sit down with him, but he runs Catawtons out in Middle Tennessee. And, that was really awesome hanging out with him and hanging out with my buddy, Naren Pratt, out of Chattanooga, Tennessee. He was also down there with Sam. It was a lot of fun, but as any good sheep guy, I wouldn't be a good sheep guy if I didn't do this. We got to Georgia and I started, messaging, Stacy at Imperial Yarn. I was like, hey, hey, you think you can maybe see if I can get a tour of Kent Wool, the spinning mill? And she's like, yeah, sure, no problem. So I was like, hey Kelly, yeah, you want to you want to maybe, you know, maybe if we go ahead when we're driving to Tennessee, you know, we could just shoot over and look at it. It's super, it's like 2 hours away from where we're at. And she's like, yeah, that's, it sounds great. Only 2 hours, only 2 hour detour. Yeah, yeah, it's maybe 2 hours. So then we go.
Maybe and, 2 hours.
Yeah, it's for sure. So the 2 hour detour was actually 6 hour, you know, 6 hour detour. But she didn't need to know that at the time. And so anyway, we committed to it. We got a tour, but we ended up going to Perkins, South Carolina, and touring Kent Wool, which was just so amazing seeing that place. But so being, you know, getting to see that facility and then getting to see that kind of, I don't know, the jungle, you know, running sheep in the jungle of the South was really cool.
Yeah.
And he runs sheep and cows and runs them together. And he started with a real high intensity grazing system, and he's backed off to a, it's still a, you know, maybe a 1 to 2 day rotation. So he's still moving the sheep a lot. He was moving them like every 2 hours, 3 hours, something like that. So when he started, but he's backed off a little bit, but he's still managing these sheep and real successful. And it's really cool to go back and see that, because it's just such a different world. And
yeah,
they're so wet and there's so many bugs and the parasite loads are crazy.
Yeah.
And the volume of feed is crazy. And like just like how trees regrow back there so quickly. Like if you take a piece of ground and graze it down to nothing and then you walk away and then 2 hours later there's a 4 foot tree sprouting out of the ground. It's just, it's incredible. So
yeah.
Anyway, the whole thing was really fun and we got to do that. And then, yeah. And then, came back here and started shearing. So okay. Yeah, we're shearing weather lambs. We're not shearing our ewes that we do in April. So our lambs that are born in October, we already sheared our ewe lambs back in May. So they'll have an 11 month clip when we come back around to them next April. And then our weathers, it kind of depends on the market a little bit on whether we do this or not, but market's down. So we're going to do it. Cause the wool's worth more than the meat price right now. So we run them to 10 months, shear them at 10 months and then, finish them out and sell them at like right at 12 months as a yearling.
So. And it depends on the market because shearing could cause.
Well, yeah. So like when your wool's worth 70 cents, but mm-hmm. they're worth $3 a pound, you know, live weight or 250 live weight, something like that, it's better to not shear them. Because you're not selling the wool because you're getting paid on a double the dress, but you don't need to put that extra time and mm-hmm. effort into them a lot of times. When it's worth more that way, but when it's inversed, so like right now the meat's like buck a pound or something like that. And
you don't see any difference.
We can sell for like 180.
You don't see any difference in like weight gain after this year?
You do, but I mean, even right now, as we're peeling the fleeces off, they're pretty fat on the clover. So
yeah, so it's not really a huge benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're not, it depends on the year though. If we're heavily stocked on our clover and it's been a real hot summer, sometimes you won't get conditioned on them. This year has just been phenomenal on our clover. I still can't believe how I was thinking we have 1100 we're shearing right now. And I had in my notes that we were going to, like I said, we're going to sort off like 400, I think was my number. And of the lean ones, so we'll go back in and sort the leanest ones and put them on feed to get them up because we got to get them to town by 12 months. But I bet that 400 is going to turn into 110. I mean, if we got 10%, you know, mid condition, I'd be surprised just from what I saw yesterday. They're just real fat, really, really fat, beautiful yeah. sheep. So
cool, awesome,
yeah. But we'll be doing all that Wednesday tomorrow. We'll be sorting them and weighing them, counting everything up.
Fun.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I thought it would be fun. I was talking with Austin on the way up to do our project up in Northern California. And he was like, you ought to do one about wool processing. I was like, well, what a great opportunity. Because Ryan just went to a spinning mill. And you're shearing right now. So
it's I know it's all non-seasonal, but it's just meant to be, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's weird though. Like touring that mill, it really showed me how little I know of the processing segment. And I mean, it's, I think it's very rare to find anybody in the sheep side that really, really understands that processing thoroughly. Cause man, it is just so complicated and so skilled, and so technical.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it was incredible. Like it was like drinking from a fire hose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, these fibers are so fine and they get them all oriented like the same through carding. Right. So I guess tell us what you learned of the process. So the first you guys shear. And
yes, so
comes
that's
off the sheep.
That's one thing that's unique about sheep, and I don't know if it can ever. We'd have to have some pretty sophisticated robots for it to ever be able to change. But wool, every piece of wool anywhere in the world starts with a man taking it off of the sheep. Like you cannot substitute that person removing that wool from that sheep. So that's always going to be step number one, and from like my perspective as a ewe guy or a sheep guy, you always look at that first level of contact with that production chain. And so all of our concerns are with the shears, all of our work is with the shears. You know, we, you know, there, that's where we know, that's what we're focused on, because that's what we see. Well, then it goes from there, we put it in the bales. I remember as a kid, we had those sausage tubes, those big burlap sacks that were, I don't know, they were long, and it was a side press that pressed them. And I remember at our home ranch, they'd stack them up all there and they'd make these pyramids and you'd get to like run and jump from one to one to one. It was super cool. And then, but now they use these squared bales, they're nylon squared bales. And we'll pack them in there. Our square bales tend to be, around 410 pounds, 425 pounds is what we try to shoot for. If you don't pay attention, those bales can pack as light as 350 or as heavy as, you know, 500 or 600 sometimes, depending on the density of the wools and types of what's in there. But that's really important to pay attention to your weight of bales for me, because when you put the wool on a container ship, on a container, for a train or for the boat, mostly the boat traffic, because I think it's like 90% of wool goes overseas out of the U.S. They pay per square foot. They don't pay per pound. And so you want to be able to stack that container as full as you can. And it just makes freight more efficient when you have evenly stacked bales and heavy. So if you have every bale weigh 400 to 425, that would just be perfect for me. I've never done that and probably never will. Unless I have a dream of getting like a scale, like getting my own press with a scale that I can have every single bale, like exactly the right weight with like a barcode on the side that I can zip and scan. And yeah, that's like a dream, but that'll be 10 years from now. But
I'm sure they exist. Yeah.
Well, they definitely do. I mean, yeah. I saw it in Australia. They do that. And it works really well, but just our wool market, there's just not enough value in the wool market right now. And I would like to talk about that just a little bit, but remind me of it. So make a note and ask me about that again, because I want to talk about like the value of American wool and how it's viewed by these trendy businesses. Patagonia. All right. So so it goes into that bale. And then that bale goes to a wool warehouse. The common ones that are used, I'm sure there's a few there. I know there's others in the rest of the U.S., but on the west side, pretty much everybody uses Roswell Wool or Utah Wool Marketing. So those are going to be auction houses and wool warehouses. Some like we deliver ours down to California Cotton in Bakersfield through a lease agreement that Roswell Wool has. And then they weigh and core test each of the bales. And it's super important that core testing is done correctly, buy that kind of third party machine. I mean, you can do your own core test, but it's extremely difficult to do it accurately and correctly without some machinery. And so most ranches won't have that machinery, because if you shear once a year, why would you buy a machine to do one thing once a year? So, and they do have like spectrometer tests and things that they can test individual fleeces. But like I said, to actually do the core testing, it's really important to have it done at one of those warehouses. And then they're developing a testing lab in Texas. I think Texas A&M is putting one in right now. But we used to go through Yoko McCall, the industry did, but they shut down here a couple of years ago. And so we've been going through a lab in New Zealand, which has been, the test results and things have been very good. And it's been efficient and on time and those kind of things, but we've had some logistic issues because COVID. There's been supply chain issues, and we had some wool get caught up in customs for some silly reason this year. And, I mean, it's crazy how much, I don't know. With COVID, the supply chain issues are it's bizarre why they happen. And it's almost like somebody at a desk just like makes a decision, changes something, and then like pushes it into a corner and forgets about it. And then they go about their day doing something else. And it's just weird.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we get the lab test that tells us our length, strength, microns. We color test our wool so we can see our color qualities. We'll do that on our fleece wools. We won't do that on all of our wools because it costs more to do it. But and then you get your your spectrum that tells you like how many 30 micron fibers are in the clip versus 19 microns, and usually it's going to be a bell curve, and then you get your average micron. So it tells you how tight your bell curve is or how wide it is. And it also can give you some indications. So we'll use that. We'll reflect on that. And then the next year at shearing, we'll say, okay, we want to remove 5% of the wool off the coarse end in order to increase our micron by 1%, or we'll remove 15% of the wool to increase it by 1.5, or, you know, you can use that information to inform better decisions next time you're shearing, for when you're sorting your fleeces out, because we do want to put as much volume of our wool into our main line, but we want to put the right wools. And so you don't want to just throw in a bunch of super heavy, strong wools if you're doing a fine wool clip, because that fleece doesn't hide. You know, when you get to the processing, it's amazing. Like in the spinning mill, how you can't hide a 30 micron fleece. And a bunch of 19
stands out like a sore thumb.
it's there, and so you can't hide it. So anyway,
I think you had mentioned too before where just on the sheep there's inconsistency in where they might have finer wool versus coarser.
Yeah, there's an up to 2 micron difference on the most exaggerated example from the neck, front shoulder neck, to the hind end on the top of the back on the butt. You'll have that much difference in the microns just within a fleece. And so like that's when you're looking at your sheep and evaluating your wool, it's super important to not just look at that lab test, which is the easiest thing to do. It's super important to be at shearing and see that wool coming off of that sheep, because your hand, the hand in the wool is very important. We had a fleece come through yesterday, and it was probably a 32 micron, or, you know, it was a super strong wool, but extremely long and extremely soft and just a really beautiful, beautiful fiber. And so we kept it in because it's going to add some quality attributes to what we're doing. And it's not going to be, you know, that one fleece isn't going to be itchy with what we're doing with our wool, because it's because it has these other things that are good for it. Whereas the short coarser wool, like a short 24, feels a lot rougher, and that's going to be itchy. So a lot of times that itchiness is going to be coming from that coarser wool that might not be a 30, 32, it's actually maybe only a 24, but it's just really rough in its hand. The other thing too,
shorter, which I'm sure affects how well it spins. So
that's the main thing we're looking for, is we're sorting out those short fleeces at, you're, because we want to hit a 3-inch clip is what we're targeting. We'd be very lucky if we get it. We're probably, what I saw, the wool we saw yesterday, we're probably right at like 2.8, 2.9 inches. So we'll probably just miss three, but it'll be good and long enough that it'll still sell. And then we also, if you do process in the US, we do have superwash capabilities, which, so from the bale and the tests, you know what you got. You take that to the scouring facility. I've not been to a scouring facility. Well, I've been to some small places, but never that there's one major one in the US, Chargeurs. There's a couple other big ones, Bowman in Texas, I believe. And I think I'll get a bunch of hate mail. I can't remember if there's any more, but I know Chargeurs does most of the custom work. And anyway, and they also have what's called a superwash. And what superwash does is I'm going to tread in heavy water here, but it basically does it descale the fiber?
Yeah, I think
that's correct. Yeah. The right term. So it basically descales the fiber and it takes a coarser wool. And when it takes those scales out of that fiber, it allows it to be one, machine washable. And two, it takes that roughness off of the edge of the fiber, which creates a softer feel. So you could take a slightly coarser wool, superwash it, and then it feels comfortable. And it feels like 1 or 2 microns lower than it actually is. So you take a 22, superwash it, it'll feel like a 20 kind of thing.
And it changes a couple of the quality or the characteristics of wool fiber, right?
Yeah, well, from what I understand, it takes, the fiber has these scales on it, mm-hmm. and it basically takes those scales and smooths them or removes them.
Yeah, so they don't felt.
Yeah, which encapsulates the fiber in more of a single fiber rather than a, it's different. It's great for socks. Like, that's mm-hmm. the absolute perfect thing to do if you're going to make socks. Superwash fiber for socks is incredible because it makes them feel softer, they're more elastic, and you can wash them in the washing machine. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so there's that. But scouring is basically cleaning. And like I said, there's so many different layers to cleaning because you have vegetable matter content that you have to get out. There's different processes for that. There's just the straight up washing. There's the removal of the lanolin. There's the superwash, which is that, if you need to descale, if you need to do something to the wool above and beyond that, there's that. And then,
And as far as I know, I've never been to a scouring facility either, but it seems it's not as easy as just like throwing it in a washing machine because otherwise it'll all felt. So you still have to maintain kind of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know how it is done, but
yeah, the scaling is the scaling up of the cleaning process is extremely difficult. So, I mean, there's a lot of smaller mills that are extremely successful, but they can only handle batches that are so large in volume to a limit because the type of facility they have, but then also that attention to the fleece as it's going through the process. Like,
right. It can't be agitated too much. And
yeah, it's an incredible skill. So I haven't been through a scouring plant yet. That's on my list though.
Next. Yeah.
And so anyway, so I know there's a lot there that I'm missing. I know there's a lot I'm forgetting. And then after it's clean, then they put it in, what do they call it? Isn't it top form? Where it's like, that's the clean, they're like fluffy rolls.
Mm-hmm.
Or like, anyway. Like
roving, sort of? No, roving happens after carding, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so carding is right after cleaning.
Yeah.
And that's where you take it and you're basically interweaving the fibers loosely, getting it ready to be spun into yarn, right?
Yeah. They look like, to me, they look like dog brushes.
Yeah.
Bristles are really fine. And
yeah. And there's different there's different types of cards. And so then, all right. So then it'll go from the scouring facility and some have carding capacity. Some don't, depends on where they're at and what they're doing. But anyway, then they go to the spinning mill. And so what I got a tour was a spinning mill. And that was just, there's just so much skill in turning that wool into yarn, because you take it from this carded material. So it's like a big drum, and it has this, the wool comes out, and I don't know, it's kind of it's like the shape of a pool noodle, but it's made of wool. Yeah. And so anyway, they take that and they run it through additional carders. And one of the coolest ones is they were making a natural gray yarn, and they had black, natural gray, and a natural white. And they were carding them together, and they ran it through the carder four or five times. And then they come out with this beautiful gray.
Oh yeah. To get it to blend.
Blend. But they have to keep going through these carding machines. And so all of this fiber that comes in, it goes through a carding machine. You know, it doesn't go through once. It goes through multiple times, depending on what the end goal is. And you got, you know, yarns are coming out of this place for everything from Italian suits to woven rugs to, I mean, just everything. They're making all sorts of different stuff. So they actually have their own testing equipment there where they're testing their fibers to a much finer scale than the tests that we get in the bale.
That bell curve.
To narrow the bell curve, but to understand exactly what they have. So they know exactly what they have to do to get the product that buyer or custom work requires. Mm-hmm. And there was some beautiful 19 micron for some Italian suit stuff that was getting made, and like the carded wool. It was incredible to handle that. It was just
it's like so, a cloud.
Oh, it's amazing. But anyway, so they go and you got to do all this carding work, and then you go and then they start spinning it. And so they'll take that carded yarn, and it's amazing because you can't see it. Like the yarn is so thin sometimes. Yeah. You can't even see the yarn, and they'll take it and spin it and put it on these spools. They're like 6 inches long. And I don't know. There's, like I said, I was excited to get to go through it, and I was drinking from a fire hose. So I know I'm missing a lot, but you'll get the point at the end. But anyway, so like that yarn goes on those little spools, and then from those little spools, they'll get respun. And they'll usually mix a couple of them together. So you'll have like 1, 2, 3, you know, it just depends on what they're making.
Yeah. And that's called a ply, right? When they ply them together, where you spin two different yarns together.
Yes. And that'll make a little thicker, stronger one, but it depends on the customer. Some want a single, some want a three, two ply, whatever it is. And so they'll basically take these and re-spin them. But one of the processes I didn't realize they had is they have to spin it at a specific temperature. Because wool absorbs moisture, and so they're pumping air through all these machines constantly to make sure they have the right humidity. And remember, you're in the South, so there's a lot of water in the air. Anyway, they're pumping this air through these machines to make sure that the humidity is correct, and then they spin it at a tension. So, like, if you take the yarn and let go of it, it'll roll up on itself to a certain level. But like, each customer is requiring a different type of yarn. And so that tension is different for every order kind of thing. It's so technical and skilled, this process. And so they'll take it and they spin it, and then they have to humidify, or they steam it. Mm-hmm. And then, so they'll take it and spin it at a tension and then steam it. And then that creates your yarn that'll then lay. And then sometimes they'll have to steam it 4 times, or they'll have to take it and put it on a spool to get that tension and steam it. And then they have to re-spin it just onto another spool and then steam it again and then put it onto another spool. And so they're repeating this process 4, 5, 6 times to get the right product.
Yeah. And from what I understand, and again, it's probably even less, but is that the water kind of, because wool goes through so much tension and all of those, that processing, and the water kind of helps it relax again. Mm-hmm. And so you spin it, and then you kind of get it to relax a little bit. They spin it again, get it to, and like you said, so then it lays. So it's not all kind of coiled and ready to
springy, but then you maintain the elasticity in the fiber. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and then they had another cool machine where they were putting these on these rolls, And it would measure, it had a like a laser scan, and they'd run the fiber through the laser scan, and it would measure every single piece of that basically. And it was basically checking for deformities or weaknesses or issues. And it was a robot, and it would literally slice the wool. When it would catch it, it would slice the wool, pull it down, throw another string on, re-spin it, and go. And it was just like so quick. It was a matter of like 5 seconds. It would just like stop it, chink, 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 and keep going. Wow. And it was reading that every single fiber is going through this thing. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible. And so, so then you have that. Then the wool goes on to the dyeing factory, where it gets dyed different colors. Some wools, can wools be dyed? They can be dyed pre-spinning.
Yeah. I think a lot of people will buy roving that's already been dyed. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can buy it, you can do it before or after, but they do have, you have to dye it. And so, and that's a whole process. And if you have deformities in your wool, or deformities probably isn't the right word, more inconsistencies in your wool, that will show up in the dyeing, because the way the color attaches to the fiber is different for the different types of fiber. So if you have some wools that are different, sometimes the color, if you're dyeing a red, you'll have these splotches pop up in the red, or you'll have different things. So you have like this whole process of dyeing. I don't know anything about that. And then from there, then you go to weaving, or they weave it into fabric. And I don't know anything about that. And then from the fabric rolls, then you have to have your fashion designers to design what they're going to make out of it. And then you have your tailors and seamstresses sew it and make it. And it's just, it's such a process, a huge process. So that was
and the
pretty...
weaving, right? Like, I think you can weave just the natural color and then dye it, kind of like what you were saying with dyeing it before spinning, or I think all of those just change the end product. So like plaids, like, and then, you know, like Pendleton Wool Mill, their blankets, that they're using yarns that are already dyed and then weaving them in a pattern.
Yeah.
And which, you know, just looks a little bit different than if you have a fabric that then you're dyeing afterwards.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. It's so cool.
Yeah, it's super complicated. And I guess the one thing that was really surprising to me, or I don't know, it could be concerning too. And so I think one of the biggest problems with our wool industry is the amount of technical knowledge that it takes to run one of these facilities is absolutely incredible. Like, there is so much knowledge in that person's mind, and developing new talent to work up into those positions is seems lacking, right? I mean, that's a lot of information to retain and learn, and especially starting as a, the wool mills were a very blue collar job, right? You go to work, you start in the mill, and you work your way up over time. Like, you cannot get to the top of a wool mill right out of college with a college degree. You have to have some kind of apprenticeship, and a company can't spend a lot of money to start apprentice. It takes time to build that, and just retention of employees. And with COVID, there's been so many employee issues there in all levels of those factories. It's been really pretty amazing. And then the other side of that is you got one, maybe two scouring plants of volume in the US. You got one major spinning mill. You got one major dye house. That's a lot of concern.
Volatility.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of, and thank goodness those are all really well-run businesses with really sharp people that are doing an excellent job. And we're so grateful that they're there, because without them, they're just, you'd have to be sending it to China. Mm-hmm. And, And that's one of the biggest frustrations it's one of the biggest frustrations. There's a book that just came out. I don't know when it came out. It was recent, but the owner of Patagonia came out and wrote this book that said, like, I want to let my employees go surfing. And it's all about how, you know, building a sustainable company and making sure they take care of everybody that works for them and looking out for the environment, all these positive things. But yet that company and a lot of major companies, they insist on, they refuse to pay what it costs to produce those fibers in the U.S. because the labor rates in the U.S. are so much higher than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And they're making conscious choices to go ahead and buy that fiber processed in Charbor in China, ship it all the way across the Pacific Ocean, process it in China and bring it all the way back because they want to protect the margins for their business and they don't want to pay more for the raw product. And so they'll come out and say that we believe in this corporate culture that allows our employees to go surfing, but they're not looking
at the full supply chain.
They're not looking at the full supply chain and they won't pay that what it actually costs to produce in the US. And until you start getting legitimate corporate buy-in from these major brands and they start bringing these textile products back to the US and paying what they cost to produce, because the cost to produce it, I mean, we're not making a ton of money on the wool on our sheep.
Right.
I mean, we can't do the sheep without the meat. We get $300 a ewe for the meat and we get $50 for the wool. So it's a small percentage of the income off of a sheep. And thankfully we have some brands, a lot of smaller brands, but we do have some that are looking to it. But there's so many of these major retailers and brands that just, you know, they're pushing all of this and, you know, want to take care of the workers, want to take care of all this stuff, but then they just will not recognize the true cost of an American made product, a quality American made product. And it's just so easy for them to, you know, buy Argentinian wool where the sheep shearer is getting paid, you know, a few cents a head. I have to pay $5 to mine. So there's a $5 difference between that wool just in the shearing cost versus our wool. Mm-hmm. Then you go and you take your processing costs and, you know, you're getting, I don't know what they're paying. I don't know what they're paying their employees in China. A lot of it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, over here in the US, we're paying, you know, anywhere from 15 to 40 bucks an hour, depending on the position. And so mm-hmm. like that, just that right there is such a huge cost and they're not willing to take that as part of their vision. You know, it's really sad. It really is.
And then there's this argument that, well, we can't meet that demand if we, right. But then it's like, well, we don't have the infrastructure because no one's been willing to pay for it. So where, you know, like, if there was a demand for domestic processing, then that infrastructure would, I mean, the problem is it doesn't just come out of nowhere, right? Like you said, there's an apprenticeship mm-hmm. type of model for this type of work. And so we need the expertise also, and that's dwindled because all of these mills have had to close, but potentially, I mean, there are smaller mills. And so the expertise is there. They just need that. They need, you know, large companies to buy into their product, and
you need large consistent expansion. Yeah, you need large consistent orders that you can count on year over year in order to justify expansion and new development. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that kind of consistency, like just so a bright side of that, so Kroger Market is strongly committed to U.S. lamb, selling U.S. lamb in their stores. That kind of commitment to U.S. lamb supports everybody else's lamb businesses mm-hmm. because it's a large, consistent HEB stores in Texas is another great one. Raley's out here in Sacramento is another great one. There's a lot of retailers that are committed to American lamb, but you get those large major retailers committed to sourcing American lamb at a premium versus the import. That supports our entire U.S. industry. That supports the farmers market lambs, that supports the small businesses, that allows me to start up my own meat company and get them custom killed at a superior facility, or go and have that facility and infrastructure. If I, if I need more lambs, I can go out and buy it. Other people are running ewes and I can go buy ewes and expand my herd. You know, all of that is dependent on large, consistent orders. And it's so important that these, I mean, so much of, yeah, it's just the cost of American production is expensive. I mean, it's very, very expensive. And, you know, when these corporations, the large, most like large wool users, when they're looking at, I mean, they're looking at an end cost of product and they want the margins, but when they're weighing those increased margins by sourcing foreign materials, they have to remember that that comes at a cost to the U.S. wool business. And by them making a commitment to go to U.S. wool, that supports us long-term and helps us grow. And the more volume we can get back into the U.S. production, the cheaper it actually would get. But it takes mm-hmm. that initial commitment.
Right.
So, yeah. And the quality's there. I mean, the U.S. quality is, I mean, the U.S. wool is great. I heard somebody said the U.S. wool tends to have more crimp in their wool than foreign wools, and which allows it to be a little more elastic.
Yeah.
Which is, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. That's cool.
Anyway. That's my speech.
I liked it. It's good.
Yeah, I cover everything. I cover everything. I don't know. I didn't. I know so little about the wool deal. I often thought that I've been thinking about how we can support that manufacturing industry a little better. I really think if the industry could sponsor some kind of like apprenticeship grants to these major facilities, would be a really good way to help kind of develop some talent.
Because
help subsidize that cost of,
right. Cause like you said, labor is so expensive, and for them to have employees and it would be a great,
well, if you did like a
expertise, like a
3-year apprenticeship program where, you know, you go to work at, you know, whatever it is at the bottom of that pay scale, you work 10 years or you work 3 years into upper management and you get like $3,000 bonus a year. That's subsidized through ASI or, you know, one of our support organizations or something. That would help so much that processor or that manufacturer to take that risk on that employee and get them to work their way up a little bit. And it gives them time to see if they're a good employee or not. I mean, not every single one would pan out, but I mean, if you got one that was able to, you fall in love with wool and be able to build the skill set over 15 years to run one of those facilities, it'd be worth it because we need it. We just need it so badly. So,
yeah.
And I think that's probably nationwide. I mean, it's not just wool industry. I think that's a lot of industry where your trade skills are declining.
Yeah.
There's just,
we kind
not
of talked
much.
About that with the meat processing, about how all these small plants are closing and how do you, you know, where do you learn those?
They struggle to hire butchers. Mm-hmm. I mean, and even welders and construction workers. And I mean, all of these skilled kind of blue collared hard work jobs, drillers I got a friend who runs a drilling company. Finding good drillers is tough. They're all 35 to 55, you know, they're all getting older. There's not a lot of young guys coming in. It's just, I don't know. Hard work's good, but it's hard, and there's so many easy alternatives. So.
Well, and like, who talks about, I don't know, is that a problem with our education system and, you know, gearing? It's great to enable or allow children the opportunities to go to college, but do we talk about career choices and what comes, you know, like what those types of options are also at a young age? And
yeah, I don't know. I know like when I was growing up, there definitely was kind of I don't know. You almost look down on it if you like go to work right out of high school rather than go to college or goof off for another 4 years. But then like now looking back and reflecting on my college years, I mean, goodness gracious, I feel guilty the time I wasted. But I mean, it was good. And I'm glad it formed me to who I am. But there's such a value in that. And it's just not, it's just not how, that's just not how people get ahead today. You know, you get ahead by switching jobs, go to one for more money. It's very rare that you find somebody go to work for a company, commit to that company and be a career employee. Like that was something that grandpa did in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And people will look back and say, gosh, these corporations got super rich on the backs of grandpa that was committed as a company man to this place. But then that's, I don't, and that's definitely true in some spots, but there definitely was a lot more stuff given back. Like Ford Motor Company would do a lot to put money into schools, put money into houses, put money into parks. And like there was a lot more.
Yeah. Employees around in their communities. And
yeah, I'd say, yeah, community centric giving back. So like you had a town, you had a company in a town and that company built a lot of the stuff in the town. Whereas now the companies give by giving to these, you know, international organizations that then spend on their pet projects. Like it's not, you know, like since I'm picking on Patagonia today, you know, they'll give money to PETA and PETA will spend it all over the world. They're not going to go and give that money to, you know, the school in San Francisco. You know, it's, I mean, maybe they did, I don't know, but you know, like it just doesn't seem as much of that as there was back then. Like, I don't know. Towns were defined by their industries and their companies and they took pride in it. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of value in that good hard work job, you know, that, and not chasing work just for money, I think is a big part of it. I mean, you do a job because you develop a skill that's valuable and you take pride in that skill. And so if it's welding, you know, you take pride in the welding, you take pride in the work you do. And then you drive over the Rio Vista Bridge and you say, hey, I welded that. Yeah. You know, it's just, I don't know. You take pride in that kind of stuff. And that's definitely what happens in agriculture. And it's hard not, it's just like that sheep shearing. Every sheep that gets sheared, every piece of wool comes from a guy taking it off. So there's some element in pride that's sourced right to that animal at the very beginning of this process. And I wish we could push back on that trend and encourage that more. And then, and part of that is the education system. I hate to just blame education because I think it's more than that.
Yeah.
And the education system is built to educate people. And so they're naturally inclined to push people to go to college to be as smart as they possibly can. Right. That's the goal that you set out at the beginning. So you can't, I mean,
but where does that exposure? Because it's interesting. I've seen both sides. I'm not saying one is, yeah, right? Like I know of families where the parents have worked in labor all their lives and they're doing it so that their children have that opportunity.
Yeah, because it's hard.
Different, because it's hard.
Yeah.
But then I also have family who do hardworking jobs and want their kids, you know, to have that same lifestyle and their kids are doing great. And, you know, so it's like, different. I don't know.
Well, I think there's a, so those hardworking jobs are hard, but you're raising a family with a college educated, I mean, you have a doctorate, you're a doctor, and it's that easy? Like, no. It's hard. Like whatever you do, life is hard. Like your work is hard. Raising kids is hard. You're building, you know, working on your family, prioritizing your family. It takes so much of yourself, like sacrificing yourself for everybody there. I mean, it's hard. Like having kids is hard. Working is hard. Like if it's easy and you're getting paid to do it, you probably it's not work and you're probably not earning that much. You know, it's not, you know, what's the benefit, you know, where are you contributing back to this? Like, I don't know. That's And there's a lot of jobs that allow for that nowadays, but I think it's an illusion. Like you say, you know, they're not wrong because you're going to give your kids a more affluent life. If you go from a working class job, push them, they go to college and they can get a higher, you know, they improve their state in life. And that's one of the goals of parents is to make sure your kids have a better chance and are better off than you were. Like that's built into us. That's why society's build You know, you don't build a pyramid for yourself. You build them for the future.
Right. And there's usually loans involved. And that's, I usually look at that as like an investment for their future. Yeah. It's not like you just go and you all of a sudden have this affluent life. Like you, you're paying for it and you pay it back. And, but it, yeah, it's just different. Like it's still hard.
Yeah. I think, and I guess like, money doesn't make it easy. And so like, actually, I think we've pushed too far that way. And we've pushed this idea that if you get all of this, everything's going to be easy. And it's not. We've all found out it's not. It's hard. It's just very hard work, and it's rewarding work, but it's hard. And so like, if we could somehow shift a little bit back and start to revalue especially just culturally, revalue those working class jobs, revalue those
trades and crafts.
You drive through the Midwest. What kills me more than anything is you drive through these little towns in the South and in the Midwest and all over anywhere that's not urbanized. And it's a service station that used to had a mechanic, and he worked there and helped everybody's cars that broke down for 40 years. They're all boarded up. They're all closed. Like that trade, that mechanic trade, is just, there's hardly any there now. Mm-hmm. And you'll drive through a downtown strip of an old highway, and there'll be four or five of these little shops. And then there'll be one Ford dealership in the middle of this, you know, three or four towns. And that's the only service shop around. Like there is no, you know, Joe's mechanic shop. And you'll get them here and there, but it's just like, that's a great example of like, here's a trade that has shifted. And like, we really need to value those people. We took them for granted and now they're gone. And so now we miss them. Yeah. And like, how can we start getting that stuff back? And I think that's true for wool. Like, you know,
cars have changed a lot too.
Yeah. Well, I know
our service shop here is like, we need to buy a new tool for one job and you never use it again because you never see that car again. And
yep. Like... No, I have a DEF system in my Chevy. I get it. Like, check engine light. Oh, DEF went out again. Yeah. But no, it's just, yeah, I don't know. There's just, I really wish we could figure out a way to start valuing, you know, valuing and honoring those guys like Labor Day. Labor Day was to support the American worker, and now it's a holiday to go, you know, go on vacation. Yeah. And we're not, you know, I mean, on that Labor Day, the point of it wasn't to celebrate, like, you know, it was to celebrate that hardworking tradesman that was able to build a successful, affluent family by working hard and working into that trade. And like, we need to start valuing that again. And, you know, when you go to the college, you go to the high school graduation, you know, add those tech schools that kids are going to, or somebody got a job right out, like a good job working for the mechanic, the dealership, the Chevy dealership in town, like that kid should be just as supported and honored as the kid that's going to a JC. You know, it's, because that's a good career choice. He's going to be okay. If he can stick to the work and work his way up, he can be as successful or more successful than every single one of those kids on that stage. And like, how do you support that more? And I don't know, just, yeah. And yeah, that's what I think. So,
yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. And we need to, like you said, I think valuing that trade and that service and supporting community, I think is a lot of it. Like looking
at
your
even,
community.
It even gets like, I mean, it requires more of us. It's even like when you're buying a shirt or something like that, like knowing what it's made of. And like, if you're going to buy a wool shirt, buy a quality wool shirt and know what it's going through. And be willing to pay a little more for that quality. Don't get caught up in that, pay that $20 discount for something that's going to fall apart, you know, half of the lifespan of something else. Like, you know, when you buy something, keep it, use it, take care of it, and, you know, look for that quality that will last time. And that, I mean, I love American wool and I support American wool, but that applies to any kind of wools or things that you're buying. So. That's an IKEA model, you know. IKEA's got, you know, a ton of stuff in it, but it breaks quick. But that's why it's so
particle
cheap.
Board.
Yeah.
But you can't. I was actually talking to Jill about that. She has this beautiful antique round table. You can't find good furniture anymore.
It's impossible. Because no one buys it. So that's the other industry that built that south, that area that we were in. It was the furniture industry. They were talking that's just collapsing because there's nobody's willing to pay what it costs for a high quality piece of furniture, you know, at scale as they were. They'd rather go and buy the cheaper things. And then I've been thinking too, it's the hand-me-downs and stuff too from your parents. Like they, you know, here's a dresser from your grandma. Here's this. Like, I mean, that's how people, you know, stock their first homes. You know, now we buy a house, you got to immediately fill it up with a bunch of furniture from IKEA. So that way you're moved in and then you can put pictures on the IG and, you know, then you can like show off how perfect your decorating skills are. But in the past you'd buy a place and then everybody would give you stuff and then you would just slowly acquire things as you could.
Yeah.
And now it's like, buy it all right now. And I don't know.
Well, and I kind of get it. Like with small kids, they're going to destroy things, but they're like scars, you know, like, I don't know. We have a table from my grandparents that have dents and things and, you know, stains, and it tells a story. And
if you have a good piece, especially wood furniture, I mean, you can sand it down, you can restain it, you can get like, but if you have particle board, you can't. You have to throw it away and get another piece of furniture, right? It gets even those stains tell stories, and you can keep the stories or you can put in some work and fix it, you know, if you want, if it's a really good piece of furniture. Yeah. Anyway, we digressed quite a bit.
A lot.
Yeah. So this is, it's been an hour and I got to go up to shearing.
Yep.
And so I got to run, but, this has been Sheep Stuff You Should Know. I enjoyed the conversation immensely. Thank you very much. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah. Have a good day, Ryan.
See you, Rosie. Bye. Bye.